Chapter 7, The Rock. My second round of chemo was at the Regional Oncology Center, better known as The Rock, pronounced Rock, and preferably in a Sean Connery-esque Scottish drawl. The Rock is a bastion of brilliant nurses housed in a horrible bunker of a building. It literally lies underneath the construction of a brand new, no doubt gleaming, cancer center. To get to The Rock, you walk into the main entrance of the hospital. You go through the lobby. Turn right past admissions and down a long hallway past the pharmacy. Then you take a left to the green elevators. Take the elevators to the basement, then follow the green light rope down a very, very, very long hallway. At the end of the hallway, turn right to another elevator. Take the elevator to the first floor, and you are at the entrance of The Rock. Now imagine doing this with half your normal red blood cells. Once you are at The Rock, you wait. First, you wait in the exterior waiting room for your blood to get drawn. Then you wait again in the exterior waiting room until you're ready to take your vitals, weight, blood pressure, temperature. Then you wait in a small examination room for an oncology fellow to talk to you. Then you wait for your oncologist to come in and examine you. Then you wait for an available treatment cubby, three walls, a curtain, a heated chair, and a TV hanging from the ceiling. Then you wait for two nurses to be available, one to hang the chemo, the second to check it. Then you wait for the pharmacy to mix up your poisons. Then you sit being poisoned for 5 hours. Then you get to go home. The first Friday I went to The Rock was an unusually busy day. I got there at 9 a.m. for a 4-hour infusion. I left The Rock close to 5:30. The highlight of my first outpatient treatment was that I got to meet my oncologist. It turns out it was Dr. B. This was a bit of a surprise, as this was our first meeting. He had been the admitting doctor all those weeks ago in the ER. It didn't matter that I had been working for weeks with another oncologist in the hospital. Dr. B was now in charge. Dr. B informed me that with my advanced stage cancer, stage 3 I finally found out months later when I requested a copy of my medical records, he was planning on doing 6 to 8 cycles of ABVD. After 2 cycles, I would have a PET scan to see how the cancer was responding. I also had to come in every week to have my blood drawn. Now, I have to stop here to explain something that took me a while to get a handle on. Oncology folks talk about chemo not in days and weeks, but in cycles. For ABVD, a cycle consisted of one infusion, sitting in the chair for 4 hours, of the ABVD cocktail, followed 2 weeks later by another infusion, followed by 2 weeks of sitting around waiting for the next cycle to start. So each cycle is roughly a month. Clear? Then let us proceed. Truth be told, the first two infusions, the first cycle, were a breeze. Far from dealing with side effects, I actually felt like I had more energy than normal. I was putting in 18 and 20 hour days. I finished up my class. I started voluntarily offering a new online course for 2,300 people. I was up till 3 in the morning, wide awake. They say insomnia is a side effect of chemo, but normally insomnia is a sort of desperation to sleep. This insomnia was full of energy. It turns out two things were going on. The first was that I was still on high-dose steroids for my low platelet count. That was no longer low. I was also receiving additional steroids as part of the actual chemo infusion. While my six-pack abs never showed up, the steroids were giving me the energy of a Major League Baseball player. You know, without the multi-million-dollar contract. Turns out, corticosteroids that suppress your immune system are very different from the synthetic testosterone used to build muscles. My wife is Zena, the patient advocate. I mentioned before how much I love my wife. I should also mention that I am also in awe of her. Having seen my wife give birth to my two sons, I am convinced that women could rule the world. They simply let the men play their games. Having seen my wife in action as both my caregiver and advocate, I know women do in fact run the world. My wife was with me through all the undiagnosed weirdness. My wife was with me every day in the hospital. My wife has been to every appointment with every oncologist I have had. She is not simply there as moral support or as a helpful ear. She is there as my caregiver and patient advocate. She doesn't let the doctor go until all our questions are answered. She is there to make sure no prescriptions are added until they have been checked against what I am already on. It was my wife, Anna Maria, who asked, "If his platelets are back to normal, does he still need to be on steroids?" As I am writing these words, I am referring back to the notes she kept throughout this. I may be the boring patient, but she is the force that ensures I am never the underserved patient. What reassuring message can I give to all the caregivers out there? Holy crap, you are screwed. I'm sorry, but my wife has been single mother, chauffeur, nurse, bully, cheerleader, dishwasher, cook, accountant, and all of that was just in the first week of treatment. No one wants to bother me, so everyone calls my wife to get an update. This leads to one of the most unexpected parts of being diagnosed with cancer. Anna Maria and I end up consoling everyone about my illness. Hello, Anna Maria, how are you doing? I'm pretty tired. I feel like I've been in a car all day driving everyone around. That must be tough. How's David? He's having a rough day today. It's just not fair. He's so young, and you have the kids, and you guys are so nice, followed by sobs. It's okay. David's going to be okay. We're staying very positive. I just don't understand why you have to go through this. More sobs. I know he's going to be fine. In fact, I think I can hear the cancer shrinking as we speak. It can get pretty ridiculous. I was once yelled at by a colleague because I hadn't done enough to let people know how to help me. On one hand, this is kind of sweet. On the other hand, wait, is that my job? I had a very good student that I spent the first 2 minutes of a scheduled advising call consoling. My wife finally let folks know that she would be glad to talk, but if she's not up to it, she's not going to answer the phone. Let me just get a few things out of the way. It is not fair that I got cancer. It is also not unfair that I got cancer. If you try to justify cancer or try to seek some deeper meaning in cancer, you end up chasing your tail forever. Does God hate me? Am I being tested? Why me? Cancer is a mutation, a mistake in DNA. Cancer doesn't hate me. Cancer does not judge me. Cancer seeks to do one thing and one thing alone: grow. Don't ascribe any more power to the enemy than is absolutely necessary. Anna Maria made it very clear to me at the beginning of my treatment that I too have one job: kill it. She'll take care of whatever else needs to be taken care of, and she has been able to draw on an incredible network of family and friends to do just that. Look, there are whole books written by and about caregivers. I am in no position to say anything other than thank you to my advocate in love. I have said it before, and I will say it again. There is no joy in cancer, save the network of love it exposes. Ninja with an X-ray. Through the first few infusions, I was still using the PICC line they had installed in the hospital. I know there is a better word than installed, but as I've said, sometimes I get treated like a car. Every morning, my wife would don latex gloves and keep the line flushed with saline and heparin syringes. Every night, I would tuck two plastic tubes hanging out of my arm into an elastic bandage before I went to sleep. Don't get me wrong. This was much better than having to go every week and have a needle thrust into my arm in search of a vein. However, a PICC line is considered temporary and needed to come out. As I was going to be in treatment for a long time, the longer-term solution to a PICC is called a port. A port sits under your skin in your chest. It is a set of dome-like membranes that needles can pierce. These domes — I have a dual lumen port, meaning two domes, so they could hook up two IVs if they needed to — are connected to tubes that run up into your neck, then into a vein and back down just outside the heart. I know that can sound uncomfortable, but you really don't know it's there. I actually think everyone should have a port installed as a baby. Every time I would go to give blood pre-port, it was an awkward scene of tourniquets slapping my arm and a frustrated phlebotomist. There's a good one, stab. Feel needle moving back and forth. It was just there. More moving. Let's try the other arm. Stab. Let me go get someone else. I'm only allowed 3 sticks. With a port, the nurse — it had to be a nurse — feels the bumps on your chest, tells you to take a deep breath, and bingo, done. It is a godsend when you are in treatment. It just needs a USB connection so you could charge your phone, and then it would be perfect. Now, to get your port installed is outpatient surgery. It is done by the medical department with by far the coolest name: interventional radiology. First, it is just cool to say. It also brings up images of doctors fighting crime with an MRI machine. You go to the doctor's office and get in a gown. Then you lay on a bed and they expose your chest, shave it, and douse it with sterilizer. Then they give you a shot of I'm not so tense juice. They then cover every part of your body, including your face, with sterile blankets. The doctor comes in and tells you, This is easy. I just need to make an incision in your chest and carve out a pocket for the port. Great, whittling is medical treatment. Then I'll push the tube up your neck and we'll be done. It took maybe 5 minutes. I felt nothing but some odd pushing. The reason it was done at interventional radiology was that they guide the tubes up in your chest and in your neck with real-time x-rays. There's another reason I love interventional radiology. I'm going to just keep typing it out. I have been to 3 different procedures at interventional radiology, and the folks there have always been hilarious. I'm not talking about nice or simply a few jokes, but flat out hilarious. For my port procedure, we ended up having a discussion of getting squirrels out of a shed by leaving tiny squirrel-sized condoms on the back porch. These are not completely normal folks, but still, I felt, my tribe. I just wish more physicians cutting into me shared their sense of humor. With port in place and PICC line removed, the chemo and bloodletting at the Rock proceeded on with a new sense of routine. After I'd finished 2 cycles, 2 months of chemo, it was time for a PET scan, where they can't use your port. Positrons and greedy cells. The best tool that oncologists have to track the spread and hopefully the retreat of Hodgkin's lymphoma is the PET scan. PET stands for positron emission tomography, and it is pretty damn cool. The basics are that you are given a radioactive tracer, normally glucose, sugar. Cells that divide rapidly need a lot of sugar to do their work. Cancer cells divide very rapidly and therefore need a lot of sugar. So as the radioactive sugar goes coursing through your bloodstream, the cancer cells and your brain gobble it up. Now, all this time, the sugar, being radioactive, is decaying and throwing off positrons. Big PET scanners can pick up these positrons and make a 3D model of your body showing anything that, quote-unquote, lights up. That will be your brain, your kidneys that are busy trying to filter your blood, and cancer cells. Now, that's the basics, but the practice is not as fun. First, your cells have to be hungry for sugar, and that means the day before your PET scan, no sugar. No anything that can quickly turn into sugar like carbohydrates. So pretty much, if you eat, eat protein. So I had fish for breakfast, turkey jerky to snack on, fish for lunch, and a nice piece of fish for dinner. Then nothing to eat or drink after midnight. The next day, you go to the imaging practice where they prick your finger and do a quick sugar test on your blood. Blood good? Great. Time for the shot. The technician brings out the syringe with the radioactive glucose in a lead box. She opens the box to reveal a syringe encased in a thick titanium cylinder. Wow, I said. Oh, don't worry, the metal is just there to protect me, she said without a hint of irony in her voice. She then injects you with the glucose and puts you in a quiet, small room with a comfy chair. Now stay as still as you can for an hour. Anytime you use your muscle, the muscles use sugar and it can throw off the scan. So you are left alone in a dark room. You can't move or you'll throw off the scan that is going to show the doctor if your cancer is retreating or advancing. Tell me your nose wouldn't start itching. After the hour, they have you pee, then lie on a flat plank. The plank moves you through an enormous donut-like machine. First, quickly, that is the CAT scan in about 30 seconds, then very slowly. The PET scan takes about 40 minutes to move you through the donut. Still, for you, no moving. It turns out my first PET scan was very encouraging. While there was no baseline PET scan to compare it to, the lymph nodes and spleens were shrinking from the CAT scan I had in the hospital. There was much rejoicing in the Lankus household. The chemo appeared to be working, which is a good thing. The bad thing is remember exactly how it was working. It was killing cancer cells. I remember tweeting out how frustrating I found the chemo information sheets. They all had the heading to the effect of, "What does this drug do?" They all said, "Kills cancer cells." My friend Jill tweeted back, "You would rather tickle them?" Good point. However, the trick is that chemo doesn't just kill cancer cells. Like that radioactive sugar from the PET scan, it kills rapidly dividing cells, and this leads to an increasing set of side effects.